The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Joy for Charlton and heartbreak for Sunderland. A last-minute winner means the Addicts get promoted to the Championship. Joy for Tranmere and heartbreak for Newport. A last-minute winner in extra time means we all had to endure more pictures of that Premier League ref celebrating. Joy for Celtic, a treble as they scrape past Hearts into the cup final and give Neil Lennon the job full-time. There are cup wins for Valencia and Bayern while Atalanta make it into the Champions League. We'll do all that, start gearing up for the European finals, discuss referees scoring goals and Oliver Kahn being nasty to children. All that on today's Guardian Football Weekly. A question from Dean. Is Barry currently MIA in the Trafalgar Square fountain? To be clear, he was booked off this pod before the Sunderland result came in, but Jonathan Wilson can represent anguished Sunderland fans well. How are you, Jonathan?
I'm a bit hungover, to be honest, Max.
Yeah. Are you sad?
I suppose so, yeah. I mean, I'm sort of just generally had an aggravating weekend because I got a shocking LBW decision on Saturday. I dropped an easy slip catch in my final game before shoulder surgery.
Okay.
So it's been a tough weekend.
Okay. Bringing some enthusiasm, hopefully. Ben Fisher, hello.
Hello.
You went to the game professionally.
I did.
Okay. Did you feel sick for Sunderland or just joy for Lee Bowyer?
I did feel sorry for them. I definitely did feel sorry for Sunderland. What a job Lee Bowyer has done, though. Mm. Superb job.
Hasn't he? Faye Carruthers, hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Just a couple of points of admin. Slightly late.
Yes, apologies.
You have a hot breakfast there, which I'd like to say I've not said you can't have.
You haven't, but you did give me a look.
Well, I've got a mini break coming up. So, you know, I've got to get to Suffolk after the pod. But if you want to have it, I'm happy to pour. We wouldn't play out you eating the breakfast.
It's fine.
Are you sure?
I can wait. I have patience.
What's the hot part of it? The halloumi?
The halloumi is hot.
Yeah.
The beans potentially are hot. The egg's hot. The whole thing's hot.
Oh, no. Cold egg. That is going to be devastating anyway. Well, you know, should have got up earlier, really. Charlton 2, Sunderland 1. Major says, how does Jonathan Wilson find the strength for this pod? Will he simply moan throughout? Grant says, would Jonathan like my Netflix password for Sunderland Till I Die season 2?
Will he simply moan throughout? I mean, that's what I do.
Yeah.
Like, don't take away my one kind of USP. I mean, Charlton finished the season much stronger than Sunderland. They got more points than Sunderland. And yesterday they were significantly better than Sunderland. So they deserve to go up. Sunderland, I think, look pretty lightweight in midfield. I think playing power with Leadbitter and Catamol was an attempt to alleviate that. Him going off as early as he did, you know, meant that we did get overrun in midfield. I thought Morgan was rubbish. I thought Catamol had the worst game I've seen him have this season. So yeah, it was pretty disappointing.
Can you sum up your emotions as that Charlton goal went in?
Fuck, not again.
What's your record?
Seen them at Wembley 5 times, lost 5 in 5 different competitions. I think the only other club whose fans could have a similar record is Bolton. And obviously they're in much worse condition than Sunderland at the minute. But for one of their fans to have been to the FA Cup final, the League Cup final, the Checkatrade or equivalent final, the Championship playoff final and the League One playoff final, they would have to have been there in 1953. However, Bolton have also lost an FA Cup semi-final at Wembley, which Sunderland have not done, although they have lost an FA Cup semi-final at Old Trafford and many other places before the Second World War.
But it all started so well for you, didn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, apart from Naby Sarr's back pass rolling under the keeper's foot, Sunderland didn't create... There was one Leadbitter shot, and apart from that, there was nothing. So Sunderland didn't create anything, didn't play particularly well.
Most people watching on TV missed the goal because...
Well, I missed it.
The director missed it because they were doing a replay.
Sort of fair enough. I mean, I don't think you deserve too much criticism,
no,
the director.
No, definitely not.
No, I turned away. I was sort of first alerted to it by my mate Michael sitting next to us, suddenly going, and like grabbing my knee, at which I looked up to see the ball trickling over the line. I was then desperately kind of scanning back through the, I don't know, the 2000 or whatever live matches I've been to, trying to work out how on earth this could possibly have...
But then how on earth do you then go on to lose a game that you've been handed a goal?
I mean, I thought even at the time that kind of thing's great when it happens late in a game, But when it happens that early, the keeper's got time to reset himself. Mm. And some of them actually, the only period of the game where they looked in control was the 10 minutes after that. Charlton were rattled by it.
Yeah.
But they had time to get over it, and then once they had, they were much better.
Nate says, given a large dollop of hindsight, do you think Sunderland may have been better to have scored their goal themselves, thus avoiding being as surprised as Charlton that they were ahead?
I think they'd have been better off scoring four or five goals. I think that would have helped.
Standard.
But
you were watching professionally, Ben. I mean, I didn't think Charlton did that much either.
I thought they stamped themselves on the game after that goal. Obviously, a dreadful start. I think you have to give credit to Dylan Phillips, actually, the way he bounced back. He wasn't sort of spooning goal kicks out of play, didn't sort of lose his head. He made a really good save from Grant Leadbitter, built on that. And Charlton definitely shaded the rest of that game for me.
Yeah, I agree they shaded it, but even still, it...
I have to say, it felt like more than shading to me.
Really? Yeah. I know the commentators were like, this is a classic. At one point they said, what is it about Sunderland and Charlton? I was like, well, hang on a second. Like, it's 1-1. Yeah. It's
They'd already decided on the narrative after that 4-4, though, hadn't they?
Yeah. But you can't decide narratives of football matches in 2019 on games that were played in 1998.
I think my favourite moment was Christian Billick when Charlton equalised. Everyone else went away to the sort of nearest corner flag and he sprinted back towards Phillips. The goalkeeper obviously made that error and gave him a nice big warm hug.
He's been there since he was 9, Dylan Phillips, at Charlton. So he's got it, like, for that to happen to him on that stage. Well, I mean, sorry, Jonathan, but thank goodness it didn't go the other way, because can you imagine if they'd have gone on to lose it? That would have just been
awful. If it had been 1-0, you could have seen some sort of Loris Karius type crying in the goal mouth. Nice tweet from Newcastle United. Say congratulations to our former Magpies midfielder Lee Bowyer on steering Charlton to the championship. He's done a great job, Ben, hasn't he? Because he's not had a lot of help, frankly, any help from above him. And to do what he's done is pretty extraordinary.
No, brilliant job. I think they only had 5 subs at the first game of the season. I think that was against Sunderland. Correct me if I'm wrong. Lost top scorer Carlin Grant in January, and Lyle Taylor sort of come to the fore. I think he finished with, you know, well into plus 20 goals. So brilliant job, him and Johnny Jackson. Fans really bought into it. You can see that, and Bowyer was loving it as much as every one of those yesterday.
Do we know what the latest is? And I'm only asking this question so I can say it in Jim White's voice. What's the latest with Roland de Châtelet?
Bowyer said he was going to be speaking to him this week. He said he spoke to him on Saturday. Wished them good luck, which was nice of him.
sort of imagine you might as the chairman.
Well, yeah, no.
Obviously he wasn't
the
there.
Owner. The owner, yeah, sorry.
I think for Bowyer, he just wants to get on with it. You know, he's only got days to run on his contract, which is mad, really. How many managers would be in that sort of position?
Well, that's not that mad with Charlton at all, because he took over as caretaker in March and they didn't give him the job permanently until September, which is just, I mean, it's just been a shambles of a club. And I'm so pleased for them that they get this opportunity. And it makes them, as Bowyer said at the end of the match, it makes them a better club to buy, you know, a potential asset for someone to come in. And they've had so many buyers pull out, you know, hopefully... Du Châtelet will be out soon enough.
Is it lazy of me to be surprised that Lee Bowyer is doing this well as a football manager? Because I am just thinking back to sort of his style of football and perhaps things that happened off the pitch when he was a lot younger, and my inability to change. That's how I view Lee Bowyer.
Yeah, but I mean, he was, for all the stuff that happened off the pitch, he was a really good player on it. Mm-hmm. I mean, he wasn't sort of somebody who went around midfield clapping people. He was capable of that, but he was an intelligent passer of the ball. He clearly understands the shape of the game. And I guess maybe if you have had that wild side and you managed to sort of rein it in a Prince Hal becoming Henry V style, not necessarily the most obvious comparison for Lee Bowyer, but maybe that helps to understand the kind of... The people can have that side of their personalities and how to try and deal with it.
Well, having interviewed him a couple of times, I had exactly the same preconceptions of what he would be like. And each time I've interviewed him, he's completely bucked that. He's been so chilled out, so laid back, almost horizontal in how chilled he is about everything, and quite softly spoken as well. And, you know, we're of the same era, Max. We've got the same, you know, memories of Lee Bowyer, and it's not one where you think that is somebody you'd jump at the chance of interviewing necessarily. But he actually really impressed me.
Hmm. Speaking of shape of the game, James says, my friend saw Jonathan Wilson at Wembley. I told him to shout, inverting the pyramid. And this isn't as good as the 1956 Hungarian Cup final. Did Jonathan hear him?
I didn't, but I was quite drunk, so...
Ah, shame. Michael says, is it better for Sunderland to have not won? Had they been promoted, would the wages they're still paying out have prevented them from actually building a championship side? Therefore, another season in League One allows them time to get the club rebalanced.
Well, this is something that Charlie Methven, who sort of runs the show, that he was saying that although income would increase by going to the championship, actually it would be worse financially because the expenditure would be greater. That was in the context of looking for new investment, which, as I understand it, will be coming in sooner rather than later. There's a consortium that I believe is very close to completing, if they haven't already completed due diligence. And I think they're going to be buying around about two-thirds of the club. Half of it from Juan Santori, who I think it was hoped would be more involved in the club, but his political career in Uruguay has taken off, and that's taken a lot of his time. And you know, there was a lot of speculative optimism that his link with his father-in-law, Dmitry Rybolovlev, the owner of Monaco, that might help. But obviously, Rybolovlev's got all his corruption cases, so nothing's developed there, if it were ever going to. So he's going to sell half his 20% stake, as I understand it. And then the rest will come from Stuart Donald. Methven will stay on. And I think, I mean, this is sort of desperately trying to kind of find some consolation in yesterday. But everything you hear, I mean, maybe Methven is like a great sort of bluffer. It's possible. But he seems genuinely to have fallen for the club and the city and have some very interesting ideas on how the club can lead regeneration in a city that desperately needs it.
Speaking of Northeastern takeovers, before we move on to the League Two playoff final, representatives of a half-brother of Manchester City's owner, Sheikh Mansour, claimed on Sunday night, this is from the Daily Mail, that he's on the brink of sealing an extraordinary £350 million takeover of Newcastle United. The closest working associate to Sheikh Khalid bin Zayed Al Nahyan told Sportsmail on Sunday night the deal is concluded between Mike Ashley and Sheikh Khaled, an Emirati member of the family who govern Abu Dhabi. Any thoughts on that?
I just think it's so sad that maybe it's a thing for every fan of every team, but I just think it's so sad when it comes to Newcastle that the fans are so sceptical about these kind of things and they're so worried that will this actually happen, because for so long they've just been sort of, I don't know, drawn along by a sort of disinterested Mike Ashley.
Although it will be interesting to see if it does go through, if any Newcastle fans who'd previously been critical of Manchester City and their ownership, and if you were hoping for a pod where that didn't come up, there's some coming up a bit later, how they will now react. Will they change their minds?
Yeah, they will. A lot of them. I mean, that's the nature of the modern world, unfortunately, that people very quickly retreat into their tribal grouping rather than necessarily looking at the issue. So, I mean, I don't know who these new potential owners are. I don't know what their human rights record and things is. But you would hope that... you'd be wrong to hope. Mm. But you would hope that the majority of Newcastle fans would...
Investigate that before... I mean, it's difficult for fans.
I do
sympathise with City and all fans who have no control over who buys their football club, right?
Well, I mean, while I broadly think Stuart Donald and Charlie Methven have been good for Sunderland, the leverage buyout, I feel deeply uncomfortable with, particularly the way... I don't think they necessarily lied about it, but it wasn't made entirely clear what was happening. Mm. So, I mean, that's a much... Obviously a much lesser issue, but I think it's totally possible to support the team while being critical of the ownership.
But then, did you hear what Sean Harvey said, the outgoing head of the EFL, mm-hmm. regarding owners, that fans should back their owners more and be grateful, because a lot of these clubs wouldn't exist?
Well, I've always been a massive fan of Sean Harvey, and that only kind of increased my support for a delightful man.
Well, I mean, although I sort of understand his point, which is you need an owner, right? And you can understand why there aren't that many people prepared to... Mel Morris is putting £3 million a month into Derby, apparently.
There's definitely a contingency of fans who expect the world from owners that's totally unrealistic. And, yeah, the people should be realistic in what they can expect.
But if the EFL did their proper due diligence, then perhaps there wouldn't be a question to answer necessarily on some of these owners.
Well, possibly, but there wouldn't also be as many owners, right? Or you know, there would be poorer people who own your football club.
So is that then acceptable to have people who... You know, I understand the balance.
Well, it has to be, for that to happen, it has to, you know, be for the whole of football, right?
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you have a you have one league somewhere where the fit and proper persons test is so strong that there's nobody with any money, right? Well, this because I mean there are rich people who I presume have earned that money fairly.
There would be some bad teams if there was rubbish owners, you know, financially rubbish owners.
It's true, but that's it's a good point you make. If we ran football,
oh yeah, well if we ran football, then
actually, I mean, I reckon I've got a price. You know, pretty easily swayed.
We'd probably you did fall out quite a lot. All, so.
I'd be there next to Infantino, shaking hands, going, yeah, no, don't worry, what you do at home is totally fine. Tranmere 1, Newport 0. Connor Jennings, last gasp extra time winner against 10-man Newport County. The story of Connor Jennings is interesting, isn't it? He was in a coma last year with a pretty serious illness, obviously. Being in a coma is pretty serious. I'm not a doctor, but and to have scored the winner is wonderful for him. On the flip side, Mike Flynn, the manager in Newport, absolutely furious that VAR wasn't used because had it been used, they'd have got a penalty in the last minute of normal time and won the game.
So I need a bit of clarification on that because I watched it again this morning. You know, Mike Dean came out and said that was a blatant penalty. Mm-hmm. Tranmere supporting Mike Dean. I watched it again and he'd flagged for offside, but they were saying that the foul had happened before the guy was offside, but he kicked the ball and then the foul.
So if I understand it correctly, as the ball is played, Jamal Matt plays the ball, he is then fouled. That incident, obviously, if he passed the ball and 20 minutes later someone ran up and punched him, that's a different situation. But as he plays the ball, he's fouled. That's one. And then the offside
played,
should be...
But it was just after. He played the ball and then he was fouled.
Well, yes. I mean, that's...
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, because presumably the ball has to have gone for the tackle to not be just a tackle, right?
Yes.
So he plays the ball, then he's fouled. It sort of happens around the same time, but that incident is seen as before the offside decision, I believe.
The more times I look at it, I'm not even convinced it's a dead cert foul, if I'm honest.
Really?
The way he goes over, I think... I don't know.
You saying he's gone down too easily?
It looked like that way to me.
Oh, that's interesting.
I think it's a penalty. Is you know, but I'm not in the VAR room and none of us are referees.
But the big question that should be answered is why wasn't VAR being used? And, you know, they've got the capacity to do it at Wembley. Why not use it?
Is that to do with the fact that it's not been in League Two for the rest of the season, so you can't chop and change with it?
It was the same at Swansea, wasn't it, in the Cup?
Yeah.
You know? It's crazy, really. If the ground's got the capacity to have it, it's got to be used.
Because that's the reason that it's not been used anywhere else during the season. That's the whole point. But if you can use it at Wembley, why not use it for a big final that is massive for both teams? You know, it's exactly the same as the amount of FA Cup games and other games that used VAR and others didn't. That's just not... It's not a level playing field. But the final is just between two teams. That's... A level,
well, you say
there's
that.
No other teams.
Yeah, but you say that. But if one of Tranmere or Newport had got through to that final on a decision that would have been overturned by VAR, then you'd have the team in the semi-final saying, "Well, hang on a second." And if the team who came eighth instead of seventh,
we could just go on forever. The start of the season. I mean,
oh yeah, sure.
It's played in a neutral ground, which no other ground game in the season is. So you know,
I'm just playing devil's advocate.
Badly,
I agree with you, Faye. Broadly, brief word on Derby Villa because that game will probably have been finished by the time you're. Listening to this, so we could either predict it and go, what a great 2-1 win for Aston Villa there.
Is that your prediction?
I think Villa will just do it. Ben, you're going, aren't you?
Yeah, I think Villa on penalties. I think it's going to go. I think we're in for the long haul.
Really? Mm. What on what basis?
I just think it's going to be... There's so much riding on it. You know, it's the classic 170 million plus game. It's going to be cagey, I think. I'm not convinced. I mean, Tammy Abraham has scored a lot of goals, but I'm not sold that actually. In a game of that magnitude, either team has that sort of striker to put away that one chance. A lot of Tammy's goals are sort of in the box, you know, rebounding. I think one chance, you know, can they...
Sort of give the impression that he's just sort of running around randomly and the ball hits him aimlessly on occasion.
He's got 26 goals this season. They're not all like that.
I love Tammy Abraham. I just think that sort of one chance you might get, I'm not saying he might put it away.
Ashley Cole could start at 38. It sort of passed me by.
Could be his last game.
Yeah. What an amazing career he's had. It's interesting that... I don't know. Jonathan, do you feel he is rated as highly Ashley Cole as he should be?
No, I don't think he is. I mean, people are starting to say that, so perhaps we're kind of coming to a recognition. But there was a time when I think he was probably the best left back in the world, certainly in terms of being able to combine defensive capacity with getting forward and getting crosses in the box. And I think also he might have been more respected had he not ended up at Chelsea, so his role would have been more attacking. So he would have been seen as a more modern fullback, whereas when he got to Chelsea, Mourinho made him a much more defensive player.
Mm-hmm. All sorts of rumours still about Lampard to Chelsea. And people, I'm hearing more and more people saying this is actually quite a sensible idea because of Chelsea's transfer ban, but even still, he has only been a manager for one season.
I don't think for Frank Lampard it would be the best move. For Chelsea, it may well be, because him and Jody Morris obviously have links with the academy, and so they would be able to take advantage of the transfer ban that's going to really make Chelsea struggle next season. So I get that, but I don't think from Frank Lampard's point of view it would be a good move, particularly if he got Derby promoted. Well, even to get them into the playoffs was pretty impressive. You know, it's almost a year to the day since he took over. But I think for his career path, it's too early for him, and he could ruin a legacy. You know, the Chelsea fans are very quick to turn.
Mm, but you've got to take the chance if it's given to you.
There's also, I mean, you're absolutely right, but the flip side of that is, what if he goes up with Derby and they end up getting, I don't know, 25 points next season through no real fault of his, just because they haven't got the squad for it, and then his legacy is also ruined. Mm. I mean, there's plenty of managers have done that, have taken the side up, and then, you know, they get pegged as a long ball merchant because that's all they can do with the squad they've got, and they end up getting relegated with 20 odd points or low 30 points. And then, you know, they're sort of pigeonholed as they can't do it with better players.
Well, it'd be interesting to see whether or not Roman Abramovich would give him his backing and ensure, whilst this transfer ban is ongoing, that he would have a job regardless, because that's the kind of thing that Frank Lampard would have to make sure was in place, that he gets given time, because, you know, why would he put himself in that position otherwise?
Because you've got to take the Chelsea job when you get offered the Chelsea job, right?
I'd quite like to just see him stay at Derby, to be honest, and get more of the old band back together. You know, who would be next? You know, Cole... Who could it be?
Who else could he get back?
Dig a couple out of retirement, maybe. I mean, Tor-Andre Flo looks after the Chelsea loanee, doesn't he?
I think we're going to say Tor-Andre Flo looks after himself.
That's a big job.
There's a lot of people. He's quite tall, so he can look down over Holland and see everyone.
It's basically the three biggest jobs in the world are managing, you know, managing Indian Railways, the NHS, and Chelsea's loan system.
On Dean Smith, who's done a brilliant job at Aston Villa, and
oh, Dean Smith's the manager, is he? Not John Terry?
Well, it's good to point that out, because so much has been talking about John Terry and where he's going to go and go to Middlesbrough. But Dean Smith's done a brilliant job, and there's a really nice piece in the paper by Jacob Steinberg today. He's spoken to him about his dad, who's a massive Villa fan, who worked as a steward in the Trinity Road Stand, but has been in a care home for 3 years, has dementia, so doesn't even know that his son is the manager of Aston Villa, which
so
is
sad.
Incredibly sad, isn't it? But he's done, Ben, a brilliant job there.
Superb job. And, you know, I think since he's had Grealish in the team as well, that's been a massive factor. Grealish does make that team tick, but Smith... You want it to work for him, don't you? A bit like Lampard, if he does go to Chelsea, you want it to work. It's his club. Dean Smith, I think, as it's well sort of documented, you know, grew up 4 miles away from Villa Park. It would be a great story. It would really be a fantastic story.
One line on Coventry, while we're on the Football League. Coventry City, they say they have a ground share venue and agreement in place for next season if they're unable to stay at the Ricoh. A planned vote of EFL clubs regarding their place in the league has been cancelled because of that. Their owner, Sisu, and Wasps, who own the Ricoh, are in talks over City staying there, which is what Coventry would like to do. They won't confirm, though, if that can't happen, that they would ground share with Birmingham City, which feels completely wrong.
Feels weird,
doesn't it?
It's a raw deal, isn't it?
How far?
Raw deal for those supporters, yeah. Again.
How far is Coventry to Birmingham? Midlands knowledge.
15 minutes on the train?
Yeah, not far.
Oh, really?
I mean, the Ricoh is a nightmare to get there, so it might actually, for a lot of people, it might be easier to get to.
I think
I went to the first ever game at the Ricoh. Hated it, never went back.
But it's further than the EFL wanting to be within 6 miles, don't they? And clearly, but Birmingham isn't. So it'd be interesting sort of view they take of that. I mean, it's a really dim view of the four.
One final line on the Football League. Cambridge United's new kit is made by Hummel.
Oh, old school.
It is absolutely beautiful. And apparently their away kit, which is yet to be released, is even better. For the first time in 30 years, I may go full kit.
Oh, wow.
Just around town. Because the shorts have got the triangles on them, and that's or the chevrons, I should say.
It's 21.8 miles via the M6.
Is that right? Thank you, Jonathan. That'll
totally dismissed your
not interested.
It's a lovely kit. I agree.
Who would you have on the back?
Who would I pick on the back? Yeah. I'd probably go old school. You know,
Dublin.
No. I think I'd go Colin Bailey, an old centre mid, bald, became a policeman.
Not backing yourself, not Rushton.
No, I think that's a little self-indulgent.
Very.
Isn't it?
Have you seen that clip of Dion doing the stairs going up to the bedrooms? Have you spoken about that?
We haven't spoken about it. It's tremendous.
It deserves a mention.
From Homes Under the Hammer, someone has put together every time Dion says, stairs going up to the bedroom. He says it about 1,000 times. And it is, I mean, to be fair to Dion, there's not a whole lot, there's not that many things you can say about, you know, a three-bed semi-detached house in Nuneaton. So I sort of sympathise with him. It is a wonderful clip. Right, but it's good we've got that important stuff out of the way. We'll start part two in Spain with Sidlow. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sidlow. Sid, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous, thanks. So Valencia win the Copa del Rey. What a way for them to end the season.
Yeah, and the season as well being the way that it's been. I mean, at the halfway stage, they were 4 points off the relegation zone. They were 10 points away from a Champions League place. They had a manager saying, you know, I can't explain this. I have no way of knowing or kind of rationalising why the season is going like this. I've never lived anything like it before. And I remember sitting and listening to him talk at Leganés. This was in early February, I think, and said, well, so how do you change this? And he said, we don't. We believe that this is the right way to go. We've just got to keep going. And at some point, this will just change naturally. After the cup final weekend, he said, we didn't change anything. Genuinely, we made one or two very, very small adjustments, but we carried on. And then by the end of the season, this is a manager who is on the verge of the sack, whose players backed him, whose director general backed him at a time when the club's owner wasn't at all sure about sticking with him. And they finished the season in that Champions League place, which they only occupied for 6 days all season, obviously in the semi-final of the Europa League, beaten by Arsenal. And then the weekend win the Copa del Rey. It's their first title for 11 years.
Did they deserve to win?
Yeah, I think they did. They were really made to struggle in the second half, and Barcelona kind of accelerated a little bit, put a lot more pressure on them. Didn't make a huge amount of clear chances, Barcelona, but one or two, Messi hit the post, and then, of course, he scores. There's a free kick that flicks off the wall. There's a couple of other kind of minor chances. But I thought Valencia were very good indeed. In the first half, they were 2-0 up at half-time, and it could potentially be more.
What now for Barca? Valverde out? I saw you tweeting that you don't have any control over this.
Yeah, it's amazing how often I get tweets from people that literally just hashtag Valverde out, and you sort of think, okay, I'll just deal with that now, shall I? Okay, I'll sort that out for you. I mean, look, he has, over the last, when did they lose Liverpool? Was it 17 days ago or 18 days ago, I think it is. There's been constant talk about his future. But the club's been actually really quite proactive and surprisingly proactive in saying, this is going to continue. Messi and Piqué did the pre-Copa del Rey final press conference. First time Messi's done a press conference, I think, in 5 years. And he said, I want him to continue. And at that point, you think, well, that's the end of the debate. But then to lose the cup final, which I think they needed to win, if you like, to kind of justify the season rather than necessarily for the joy of winning the cup. And I think that was part of it. The build-up to the final was about one team needing to win it and one team wanting to win it. And, of course, there's a difference between those two things. And afterwards, now there is that debate, and it's a debate that goes well beyond Valverde, talking about things that we've discussed all season, you know, the slight loss in style, the dependency on Messi, the weakness in the squad when key players are missing, and obviously, you know, Luis Suarez and Dembélé being missing are two very, very big names. It also extends to other players, and Coutinho has been pretty much disastrous all year and offered absolutely nothing again at the weekend. But yeah, a lot of the focus is on Valverde and whether he fully embraces or represents a Barcelona style, and whether he's managed to tactically lead the team in key moments. Because of course you had Rome last year, you had Liverpool Rome last year, Liverpool this year, and now the cup final. And in all three of those cases, Barcelona were awful, but it was not just in terms of the performance; it was also perhaps in part, at least, in terms of the setup.
And you think, I mean, you're going to have quite a busy summer, aren't you, Sid? Because there's so much for Real to do. There's something for Atletico to do. And you look at Barcelona and you think, what, De Jong's coming in? Is Griezmann going to come? De Ligt going to come? Who's going to make way for them? There seems to be so much to do at those three clubs.
Yeah, a week ago, Barcelona were very confident that De Ligt would come. They're much less confident now. Now, I must confess, I don't know what's happened in the meantime, but I imagine it's an enormous truckload of cash having been driven round to the house of his agent, who just happens to be Raiola. So, you know, it's not like he needs another truckload of cash, but that will help kind of shift the move and shift the priorities, perhaps in favour of other clubs. Barcelona would be, I guess, expected to respond to that. So it doesn't mean that this deal is dead. But as I say, they thought it was done and they're less confident now. Griezmann, we're all making the assumption, and I admit that this is risky, but we're all making the assumption that it will be Barcelona. But of course, there's still some way to go before his buyout clause officially drops to that price, 120 million. That's on the 1st of July. So there's still, you know, a long way to go until then. And I think you're right, Barcelona will be busy. And there's some key positions that they definitely need to reinforce. Real Madrid would like to be busy as well. There will be probably 3-4 signings, of which I would guess at least 2 are very big ones, starting, of course, with Hazard. And Atletico are in a situation in which they probably didn't plan this, but they now will have to be busy. Griezmann's gone, Juanfran's gone, Felipe Luis we think will go, Godin has gone, Lucas Hernandez has gone. And that's before we get onto others who might depart. You know, there's almost certainly going to be a big offer for Rodri, which would be his buyout clause. In other words, Atletico wouldn't be able to stop it. I wouldn't be that surprised if there's moves for Saul. And then, of course, you ask yourself, at what point does this tip? At what point does players who weren't planning to go, at what point do they think, well, hang on, everyone else is going. I'm not hanging around here. And so I think there's going to be some very, very significant signings from all three of those clubs. So I hate to say this, but we've got 3 months of this still to go.
We'll just carry on doing pods and ringing you up, Sim, and asking you, making you make decisions that are beyond your control. Now, we spoke last week, we didn't speak to you, but on the pod we did, about Javier Tebas, the La Liga president, saying that PSG and City should be thrown out of the Champions League. Man City's chairman, Khaldun Mubarak, is in the papers today responding, saying, there's something deeply wrong in bringing ethnicity into the conversation. It's not clear that Tebas actually did that at all. Mubarak also says there's a clear attack on the Premier League. I know people don't want to defend Manchester City, but for God's sake, start defending this league. Were you surprised that Tebas made those comments? Or, I mean, he's got an audience he's talking to, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, bear in mind that Tebas has been saying this kind of thing for the best part of, I mean, I don't know, 18 months, 2 years now. He's talked consistently and very directly and very pointedly. You know, there's been no attempt to stand back or to dress it up in niceties about Paris Saint-Germain and Manchester City. He's talked a lot about the financial engineer. Remember that comment at a summit maybe around about a year ago when he talked about pissing in the swimming pool?
You know,
this is an ongoing thing with him. He's very, very conscious. And of course, in a way, the response about defend the Premier League, in a way, this is kind of part of this. Because, of course, Tebas has a couple of things that he's very, very focused on at the moment. One is trying to suggest that this idea of a Super League can't work. Why? Because, of course, it's a threat to La Liga. And his job as president of La Liga, among many other things, which he does better or worse, depending on the particular element, is to protect the Spanish League and to promote the Spanish League. So that's the European Super League element. And, of course, the Premier League is the other one. And there's no doubt about this. And however reluctant they are to say this publicly, one of the things that drives a lot of the decisions that La Liga are making, and, of course, this includes that decision to try and take a game to Miami, which in the end didn't happen, but I think will. One of the things that's driving La Liga in all this is a very clear awareness that the Premier League's power is something they can't compete with. That they are concerned about this. They're concerned about the Premier League effectively becoming a footballing NBA where all of the good players end up going there. They're concerned about the talent drain from Spain. They're concerned about the fact that next time there's a Messi or a Ronaldo, he may want to go to England instead of coming to Spain. They're worried about that. And so this is all has to be seen within that context. But in particular, of course, they're looking at this and saying, well, it's one thing competing with the TV rights. It's another thing competing with what they always describe as in Spain as state football clubs, you know, clubs that have unlimited resources. And of course, then that always draws the focus onto Paris Saint-Germain and onto Manchester City.
Finally, Sid, is Madrid looking forward to welcoming hordes of Liverpool and Tottenham fans?
I don't know if it is or not. I mean, it's curious, actually, because it hasn't been the real focal point yet. I guess it will become that this week. And you know, you've seen the front page of Marca today talking about the fear of the number of fans coming. I was actually talking to someone at UEFA about this a couple of weeks ago, and he was complaining about people complaining. He was saying, you know, all these people whinging about it. Do they know how much money these football fans are going to bring to Madrid? How much they're going to leave behind? How good it can be for the city? Now, of course, you might argue that a guy from UEFA is bound to say that. But I think there's a certain degree of excitement. I think there's a certain degree of warmth as well to both of these clubs, and indeed to the two managers. But of course, there's always, that's always laced with a little bit of concern if you know, at the possibility of 60,000-70,000 people turning up. But you know, given that someone sent me a list of flats the other day available for people to rent if they wanted to come to Madrid, and these were pretty pokey flats in most cases, and they're asking for €1,000 a night. So, you know, I suspect that people who are making that kind of money probably don't mind too much.
How much are you putting the ham garage on Airbnb for?
No, I've done the stupid thing, which is to give up my house for free.
Wilson saying, not to you, Jonathan.
No, I've got a very nice flat. I'm quite happy with the deal I've got.
Oh, really? So you didn't want to stay at Sid's?
Wilson's a genius. Wilson's always well ahead of everybody else. You know, the key is not to do this when you know your team's in the final, but to run the risk of your team not getting there and doing it in advance.
It's never a risk of Sunderland not getting there.
Sid, we'll see you.
And if they did, they would lose.
Of course they would. Sid, we'll see you on Friday.
Cheerio.
Cheers, mate. Sid Lowe, out in Spain. To the Scottish Cup final, Celtic beat Hearts 2-1, the treble for Celtic. That is some achievement. Jonathan, do we underestimate what sort of achievement that is in a sort of myopic view of what Scottish football is from down south?
Maybe. Just, you know, in that, when you have two knockout competitions, obviously something can go wrong at any moment. But at the same time, Celtic are, by a massive margin, the best side in Scotland, and at the moment have the most resources of any side in Scotland. So,
I mean, they were pretty lucky, I thought, in this game. Hearts were very dogged. They went 1-0 up in the second half. Like, the absolute high point of the game, but as I ask you a question about being critical of Scottish football, was the Hearts kickoff for the second half, where there wasn't even a pretense. The guy just booted it out of play, just territory right in the corner. I tweeted this out, not as a commentary of my view of Scottish football, because I just thought it was a funny kickoff. Some people didn't react in the best possible way to that.
Very quickly, on a general theme with this, I think one of the biggest changes we've seen in football over the last, say, 11 years, I think 2008-09 is a real watershed moment in football, partly because Guardiola came in, partly because you suddenly get a bump in the number of goals per game and knock-out stages of the Champions League. Football used to be a territorial game. It's now a possession game. So possessions replace position.
Really?
And so Hart is still playing old-fashioned football, going for territory.
Although,
but modern football is all about control.
Although Tottenham, who are in the Champions League final, knock it long from a kickoff. I mean, they try and keep the ball in play.
Yeah, so there's a more balanced form. But City, clearly, it's all about possession. Position's much less important to them. So it's not one or the other. It's a sliding scale. But I think that scale has now shifted at the highest level, radically towards possession rather than position.
Anyway, it was a good second half. Ryan Edwards put Hearts 1 up. Two defensive lapses. I think Edouard dived for the penalty. It's one of those where he moved his leg, so it made contact with the goalkeeper. And then Christophe Berra out of position. A second finish was excellent from Edouard. Mentioned for 16-year-old Aaron Hickey. Started only a second game for Hearts at left back. At 16. Do you think Celtic fans will be happy at the appointment? Because Neil Lennon was told when he was in the shower that he'd got the job full time. Hard to do contract negotiations when naked.
I think the players only found out through their official Twitter account as well.
Is that right?
It's clever on the part of a director, though. Get him when he's vulnerable. Kind of, he's signed this, Neil.
Yeah.
I can have a towel. No, just sign it. I mean, it feels slightly underwhelming from the outside. I guess Celtic fans have a level of warmth towards Lennon.
Mm-hmm. That's what they know what they're getting, right?
I guess the you would expect Celtic's domestic domination to carry on sort of unhindered. I mean, yeah, they might lose in a cup because that can happen, but it's not an appointment that makes me think there's going to be a sudden radical upshift in their European form, which is what Celtic really need to do.
There's a video doing the rounds of a Celtic fan, I don't know if it's real, with treble. Have you seen this tattooed?
Misspelled.
But he's spelt treble, T-R-E-B-E-L.
Oh, no.
And is informed on the video that's not how you spell treble. He takes it reasonably well, to be fair. And also, well done to the fan who was on a set of traffic lights for Celtic's parade, and people in a window above were giving him cans of beer hung on a fishing rod, just wound down to him. St Mirren stay in the Scottish Premiership. They won on penalties against Dundee United. They won the penalty shootout 2-0. Dundee United missed all their penalties, which is joyous, isn't
reminiscent
it?
Of the 1986 European Cup final when Barcelona missed all their penalties.
Did
and
they
lost
really?
To another Stower. Well, Helmut took it and saved all four.
Who did he save them from? What, 86? Who did he save them from?
I can't remember. Peachy was one of them, definitely. He'd come off the bench for Steve Archibald.
I mean, taking Archibald off was a mistake.
I think picking
it?
Archibald was a mistake. I don't think he was fully fit. I mean, this is probably not the argument to get back into now. But
Alex Anko, Pedraza, Pichi Alonso and Marcos.
Yeah, there you are.
There we are.
By the way, this is so irrelevant, but that just shows how sad I am. I was just checking Treble. There is an Adrian Treble who's a French footballer, so he could be an ode to him. We could change it to. And there is also a town in Germany called Trebel. So
thank you so much. 14 Romanians in the 13. Excuse me, 13 Romanians in the of the squad of 13 for Steaua Bucharest, and 9 Spaniards, 1 German, and a Scot.
Different world
in the Barcelona squad back in 1986.
Steaua. The first four penalties and shit were missed, so two each. Then, what's he called? The centre forward,
Majerou, Baloney,
no,
Lacatouche,
yes, scores the first penalty.
Mm-hmm. You can tell one of us is reading from Wikipedia here, and one of them using their mind.
And Steaua also, they registered a 35-year-old who hadn't played all season, was working as a coach, who came off the bench. With sort of 10 minutes to go to kind of calm things down.
Marin Radu?
No, his name, he's, I should be able to remember his name. If I weren't hungover, I would
remember. Angel Iordanescu?
Iordanescu, yeah.
Right, came on in the 72nd minute.
He went on to become the manager.
Ah, excellent news. First with the news here at the Guardian Football Weekly 1986 edition. Right, that'll do for part two. We'll start part three with Paolo in Italy. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Before we go to Paolo, Jonathan, you wanted to pick up on the most pressing story of the day, the 1986 European Cup final.
Well, no, I think it remains very relevant to modern football because Barcelona had not won the European Cup at that point. They've got the game in Seville. Steaua could only take, I think, 200 fans because of Romanian government restrictors, how many could travel. So you're never going to get conditions more conducive to Barcelona win. And they didn't. And Pep Guardiola had been a ball boy in the semi-final when they come from 3-0 down to draw with IFK Gothenburg, beat them on penalties. So he's this 14-year-old youth player at the club, massive fan of Barcelona. And I think that game contributed to this neurosis he has about the European Cup, that it's somehow not for him, it's not for Barcelona. And although he subsequently won it once as a player and twice as a manager, I wonder if that slightly infects his way. You know how he seems to overthink big knockout games in Champions League now. I wonder if that sort of childhood neurosis about the European Cup and the sort of general neurosis that Barcelona had, if that still affects his psychology.
It's a very good point, one which I can't add to. But maybe Paolo Bandini can. Last day of the Serie A. Let's talk to Paolo. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good. Do you want to contribute to the 1986 European Cup final or tell us about Atalanta qualifying for the Champions League for the first time on a dramatic final day?
I think I'll leave 1986 to Jonathan and I will tell you about what was an absolutely bonkers last day in Serie A, to be honest. So I think it's been a while that I can think of in any league that I've had the opportunity to witness quite such a ridiculous end to a season. I mean, you had three teams going for two Champions League places and then three teams essentially mixed up in the relegation battle as well, two of whom were playing each other. And the race for the top four in particular just basically kept changing hands constantly because you had Atalanta, who, of course, we talked about on the show before, the greatest fairy tale of Italian football this season and started the day in third place. Well, they went behind very quickly to Domenico Berardi goal against Sassuolo. Then they managed to equalise before half-time. In the meantime, Milan have gone two goals up against Spal, which they then blow. So they go from 2-0 up to 2-all against Spal. Inter start off creating hundreds of chances against Empoli, but can't score any of them. Finally score at the beginning of the second half, and you think they're okay, while Milan have been pegged back. And okay, now Atalanta are winning because Sassuolo got a very odd sending off. And then Inter managed to blow it as well. Inter go from a goal up and cruising at home to Empoli, who are 17th in the table, admittedly fighting against relegation, but nevertheless a team a long way beneath them. They go and blow it, concede a goal, they're giving up some crazy chances. Then they score again through Matt Nainggolan. You think, okay, finally this is it. Inter at home, they're across the line. But from there, Danilo D'Ambrosio puts the ball into his own crossbar in the 89th minute. Handanovic has to pull off a fantastic reflex save in the 92nd minute, just consistently trying to blow it over and over again. Finally, then you think they've done it after that when Brozovic scores from halfway, only for that to get pulled back because Keita pulled the goalkeeper back. The goal was on from halfway because the Empoli goalkeeper cut from a corner and was in the Inter penalty area. Keita pulls him back for no reason as they're chasing forward again, gets himself sent off. So just absolute sort of constant nonsense everywhere you looked. And I just thought it was hugely, hugely entertaining.
How many tellies did you have? I mean, how do you consume all of these games?
It's not easy. It's not easy. I had three active screens, which was enough to keep an eye on the three games involving teams chasing the Champions League places. The one game I didn't have up throughout was Fiorentina against Genoa, which I think was the right call because Fiorentina and Genoa played out. There's all this sort of enjoyment and thrilling football happening everywhere else. They played out an especially dull 0-0 draw with the situation being there that Genoa knew that they would stay up if they drew as long as Empoli lost to Inter. Now, Fiorentina just needed to avoid losing, so a draw suited them fine. But for Genoa, it was a bit of a risky strategy, to be honest with you, given how Inter played. But that was the one game that did feel like a classic late-season biscotto. I think everyone's familiar with that term now, of two teams that sort of looked around and gone, well, this result could suit both of us, so let's settle for that.
So Inter made it, right? But not enough to save their manager.
Yes, so in case that wasn't clear, because there was a lot going on that, I realised, Atalanta finished third because they won 3-1, complete the fairy tale, highest finish in their 112-year history, highest scorers in Serie A, they finished season on a 13-game unbeaten run, absolutely incredible story. I'm sure I would have said it before, but bears reiterating, working on a wage budget less than a quarter the size of Milan or Inter. Inter, because they also won, do finish ahead of Milan. It's basically, it ended up exactly as the day started. Inter get fourth place. And yes, the expectation is very much that we're going to hear in the not at all distant future confirmation that Spalletti is on his way out and Antonio Conte is on his way in. I can see how you would make a case that Spalletti's been hard done by here, and I'm certain this will be the case he makes. He's had two seasons at the club. He's got them into the Champions League both seasons. That was not a place where they were getting to regularly before. But they regressed this season. They have fewer points, fewer goals scored, more goals conceded, generally just worse than last season. His behaviour in press conferences is wildly erratic at times. And I think you could also say pretty clearly he mishandled, or at least didn't handle well, the Mauro Icardi situation. It wasn't solely his decision to strip the captaincy from Icardi, but what happened thereafter with this sort of, oh, he's never going to play for the club when he's got this attitude type comments in the press, and then the next minute he's back in the starting lineup, and then in the end Icardi starting this game when Inter absolutely needs to win at the end of the season. Indeed, I forgot to mention, or everything else happened, Icardi missed a penalty when they were 2-1 up, so when 1-0 up, sorry. So yeah, lots of situations that Spalletti didn't handle especially well. And I think given the sort of investment last summer and the sense that this team was supposed to be progressing towards being a challenger to Juventus, even though they got into the Champions League, it's still reasonable to say he didn't meet expectations there.
A couple of Juventus rumours, one about who's going to manage them. Rumour that Maurizio Sarri's agreed to take over after Pep turned it down. The other rumour being that Juventus want to swap Paolo Dybala and Alessandro for Paul Pogba.
The Sarri rumour, I think, is definitely more than the rumour. I think there's definitely conversations that have happened. Whether or not that means it's locked in, I'm not willing to go that far. But it's definitely something that Juventus are looking at and are interested in. I think it's a really curious fit because this is the club that likes to tell you that winning is not an important thing, it's the only thing that matters. Allegri liked to harp on that a lot, and the fact that he did nothing but win trophies, which is true. And Maurizio Sarri, of course, hasn't won a major trophy yet. He might on Wednesday night. So an interesting fit also because, you know, there were some barbs exchanged back when he was at Napoli, but it would be fun to watch. I'd say from my point of view, I'd certainly be interested to see what he would make of this team and of Ronaldo, and whether he could get Juventus playing a more attacking and exciting brand of football than they played this season, certainly. As for the Pogba thing, I can't really give you any sort of steer on that. There's a lot of talk going around at the moment, and I've also seen a lot of strong suggestions that, Mauricio Sarri can't wait to work with Paolo Dybala. I think the fact is he's not the manager yet, and he hasn't had a chance to have any of these sorts of conversations in any degree of detail. So I suspect, for now, that's a very hypothetical one.
Paolo, thanks for your time.
No problem.
Paolo Bandini there, watching... Three screens is tricky, isn't it? You know, because I had three screens on Saturday when I had the Scottish Cup final, the League Two player final, then I was watching England Australia. And it's, what do you favour? Big telly, laptop, phone? Because they're the three active screens I could possibly use. Can anyone go bigger than three?
Oh, well, I've been sat in a gallery before.
No.
That is different, but yeah. it's difficult. Your eye naturally gets drawn to the bigger screen.
Mm.
But then I always go on camera angles. If I can see that there's a close-up, that means that something's happened, so my eye will go straight to that to see what's happened.
I don't know if it's patience. Well, I don't think that's the right word, but I don't have that in me. I just have to make that one sort of cutthroat choice, Max.
You know, really?
It's one or the other, or okay. One of the three.
Yeah, I just sort of find you try and watch three things, you end up not watching any of them properly.
True. But sort of through the season, because there's so much football, and the current Mrs. Rushton is not a fan, and just calls it the green... I will normally have the game on the laptop, volume down, and have sort of Bear Grylls the Island on the main telly.
I'm suggesting Bear Grylls is not something you really need full concentration on.
Mm.
Well, I mean, that's
possibly... No disrespect to his presenting style or indeed the content of his excellent programme.
No, it's some people who aren't very good at foraging, not being very good at foraging. You can sort of... The narrative is already set before the season's even started.
Like Lee Catmull yesterday, not very good at foraging.
Exactly. The German Cup final, Bayern won 3-0 against RB Leipzig, clinching their 12th domestic double. They went ahead through Robert Lewandowski's excellent header. Kingsley Coman got another one, and Lewandowski scored his second late on with a nice little chip. So well done to Bayern Munich. England's women beat Denmark 2-0. Nikita Paris with a decent finish. Jill Scott with a header after a good move. 8,500 at the Best Scott in Walsall. Faye, you're going to be covering the whole tournament for the radio. How are England looking?
Well, I was there on Saturday. They admittedly said that wasn't their best game, but to be honest, they didn't really have the best preparations because they had a big media day on Thursday up at St George's Park, about 170 different media outlets. Like, it's going to be massive, this World Cup. And the night before, they'd had a load of commando training and had spent the night in tents and had about 2 hours sleep. So then had to face the media, then had an open training session on Friday.
Sounds slightly ill thought out, doesn't it?
Potentially. I mean, I don't think it was the best preparation, but it was a friendly on Saturday against Denmark. But, you know, and I did ask Nikita Paris afterwards, you know, was the preparation to blame for that? And she said no. But they, you know, they gave away six corners within the opening kind of 10 minutes. They were under a lot of pressure. Eventually, you know, quality shone out and they won 2-0. And, you know, the second half performance was much better. But that wasn't as unlikely to be the starting 11 for the Scotland game, which is the first match at the World Cup a week on Saturday. And they've still got another warm-up game, the final warm-up game, which is this Saturday at the Amex against New Zealand. So hopefully we'll see more of a honed-down starting 11 from Phil Neville.
Right, Paris is a super player, right?
She's
just joined Lyon, the best female club side.
Yeah.
But she's one of our best players, right?
Yeah, she's fantastic. You know, won loads with Manchester City. She's 25. She looks a lot younger than that. She's 25. She's got a decent amount of experience behind her. And, you know, she's going to be going out and playing with Lucy Bronze, who won the Champions League with Lyon. And, yeah, I mean, she's a great prospect. She was the highest scorer in the WSL this season for Man City. And it was a really well-taken goal against Denmark as well. She's definitely one to watch in the tournament.
We briefly touched on Thursday about Emma Hayes' comments about the size of the goals in women's football, size of the pitches as well. It was sort of four non-expert men discussing it. It was probably not ideal, but I've always minded to agree with Emma on that. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Well, I actually asked a number of players on Thursday. Karen Bardsley, who's the England number one, said, no, don't think that's, you know, advisable. I think, you know, we want fair comparisons and we want the goals to be the same. She's, you know, her and Carly Telford vying for the number one jersey. Carly Telford's 5'9". I asked her. She also doesn't want a bigger goal. Okay. Karen Bardsley's 6 foot, you know, but that's the same height as Matty Ryan, who plays for Brighton. You know, and I know there's a lot said about that. And the goalkeeping side of the women's game is probably the side of the game that is mostly criticised. But they are getting better because there's more investment coming in. They're getting better coaches coming in as well. And then I asked Fran Kirby, Chelsea striker, and she said, no, I want the goal to be as wide as possible so I can score more
Make
goals.
Make it bigger.
So,
right?
Yeah.
But it's an important thing that we sort of stop comparing the two.
Yeah, right. I would
and
say
that
so.
Constantly happens, right?
But then it's football, isn't it? You know, that's what you do. You do compare the levels of football, but it's not. It depends which level of men's football you're comparing it to, because comparing it to the Premier League is not the same. You know, it's like comparing non-league football to the Premier League. And Claire Rafferty made some really good comments, and TalkSport had the commentary on Saturday, and she made a good point saying, you know, you're just not going to see that same kind of slick passing style we're used to watching Manchester City on the television. In the women's game, you know, the ball gets given away. You maybe get 4 or 5 passes linked together, and that's the maximum. You know, it's just not that type of fluid game. It's different, but it's still football.
I wonder, because I think I don't naturally compare men and women's tennis because I'm so used to watching both, and I'm just not as used to watching women's football, so that may be why I might compare it when I wouldn't with other sports.
Yeah, probably. I see what you mean. But I mean, you know, that's the kind of argument that a lot of people have had about tennis over the years as well, is, you
True.
Know, how can men and women be paid the same amount of money when one's a 3-set game and one's a 5-set game? You know, so difficult.
Europa League final on Wednesday. Everyone's excited about going to Baku, apart from nobody who's actually going. N'Golo Kante may go, but he probably won't play. Injured his knee in training on Saturday. Very doubtful. He might be out for a while, actually. Chelsea also without Loftus-Cheek, who got injured in that friendly in the United States. Who are the favourites now for you, Ben?
I think Chelsea. Regardless of those injuries, I still think Chelsea have that bit more nous. Arsenal defensively, I'm still very worried about. I mean, how long has that been a problem at Arsenal now? So for so long, they haven't cured that sort of defensive frailty. I would quite like Chelsea to do it. I have no sort of vested interest in the game in that sense, but I would love it for Sarri to go and do it. Actually, I think he's taken so much stick, and it would be a nice finish to the season for him personally.
What do you reckon, Jonathan?
I was doing a tactical preview of the game, and I'd sort of convinced myself that Arsenal were going to win, and then I realised that I'd include Aaron Ramsey, who's injured, and wanted to take him out, and you realise Mkhitaryan, who would play at the tip of the diamond, also isn't there. And then you're thinking, well, it's Ozil or maybe Iwobi. So, given, I mean, yeah, maybe this is Ozil's great chance to prove that he does have a place in an Emery team. But
how many chances has he had?
Yeah, it's quite. And I think Emery's pretty clear that he doesn't really value. I mean, if you look back,
although
at that
Kante's
game,
not there though, that opens
it
up
reduces
some space
the energy of Chelsea's midfield. If you look back to the game at the Emirates, which was in January, I think, when Arsenal won quite comfortably. And Arsenal played a 4-3-1, you know, played a diamond field, played a 4-3-1-2 then. And they, you know, they got to Chelsea and rattled him in the first half, went 2-0 up. And Ramsey's runs from deep, you know, he was helping out the three who were sort of, you know, 3-3 in midfield against Chelsea. It was 3 plus Ramsey against 3. So Arsenal got the edge there. And he was making runs in the box, which was causing threats. So you think if Arsenal go in with a diamond again, does that create space wide for the Chelsea fullbacks to get forward, possibly? And then you've got to rely on Lacazette and how we're saying it these days,
Aubameyang.
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 No.
Oh no!
Spay. Come on.
I can't be dealing with this.
Well, that's how he says it.
Aubameyang.
Aubameyang. So the pair of them to pull wide, that's Spay. And they both have played wide in their career, so they can do that. So if they can pull wide in the space behind the fullbacks, maybe maybe there is an opportunity there for Arsenal.
We'll obviously look ahead to the Champions League final a lot on Thursday's pod. Faye, it's pretty much all about Harry Kane and his fitness, and we can look forward to five continual days of whether he should start, whether he shouldn't start. If he was 100% fit, you've got to start him, haven't you?
Oh, it's so difficult because...
Lucas Moura didn't do much in the semi-final.
Oh, come on. But yeah.
Well, that's the weird thing. He's the one who's going to miss out, isn't he? Presumably.
Which just seems... Harry Kane is a team player. He's the captain on the pitch. Well, no, he's not. Hugo Lloris is the captain, actually. I'm lying. But he's got leadership mentalities that would make him admit if he didn't think he should start.
But do you think?
Do you say?
Do you think? I'm not sure that's true.
How do you get to the point where you're like, I don't think actually I'm the best player to start on the Champions? It depends how fit he is. You know, if he is not 100% sharp, I would not play him. I would not start with him.
Yeah, I mean, yes. However, and yeah, we saw the problems with Diego Costa when he started for Atletico against Real Madrid. Five years ago, whenever that was, and had to go off in the first couple of minutes, and that is massively problematic. The other argument is, if you play Kane from the start, he can just run until he's finished and he stops. It's a much bigger problem for you if he comes on after half an hour, after 60 minutes, has half an hour to play, and then breaks down.
Yeah,
and then you've used up two subs for that. And also, given Moura's, this sounds like slightly to demean him, I don't mean it in this way, but his key asset is his pace, and that pace is probably better deployed later in the game.
He's a bit more of a super sub than than Kane.
But then on the other hand, you've got Kane sitting on the bench waiting to come on. You know, it's 1-1 with 10 minutes to go. Who else would you rather have come on?
I think that if there's a whiff that Kane can start, I think Pochettino might do it.
I think he will. Rightly or wrongly, I think he will. This tweet by @Panchero. Currently reading Tor, which is a book about the history of German football.
Really good.
Discovered that Oliver Kahn once played in a penalty shootout against a group of 9-year-olds. For every penalty scored by the kids, money was given to a charity. Kahn saved every penalty. Isn't that absolutely glorious?
Got to be professional.
Absolutely.
What's Ollie Kahn up to these days? Anyone know?
Just stealing sweets from children, I imagine. This is a tweet. Forgive me, I've forgotten who sent it to us. How much was Mike Dean kicking himself when he saw the Dutch ref score because he didn't get there first? The fourth tier of Dutch football. Haka Massey boys versus HSV Hoek. Many apologies to our Dutch listeners. The goal didn't have much impact on the game because they were 3-1 up and they went to 3-2 and then they went and won the game 4-2. Has anyone...
I haven't seen it, but I've heard about
it. So basically, he's slightly unfortunate. There's a break, a counter-attack, and the ref counters with the team quite well. He goes a bit too far into the box, and it's a shot that bounces back, hits his knee, and then just goes over the line. It's cleared off the line. It's the fourth tier of Dutch football, but he seems to have goal line technology because he sort of puts his hand to his ear, or maybe the lino is saying, that's gone in. So he has to give the goal. And actually, the team who concede the goal are pretty cool about it. Considering the ref scored.
Is that not one of the arguments that you could have for the other team deciding to take the ball up the other end? And
Possibly. From June the 1st, rules are changing. Next time you see the ball go in the net off a match official, presumably the ref, I mean, it's hard for a line to score.
That would be spectacular.
That fifth official, the one on the goal line, might slide one in.
It's a hell of a deflection.
A drop ball will be given instead. Final question from Jim. Favourite bank holiday film? Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade for me, Clive. Jonathan Wilson, what's your... Would you just watch a box set of Vera? Or would, what's your...
Yeah, it'd be Vera or Silent Witness. Or speaking of Silent Witness, FK Partizani won the Albanian League for the first time in 26 years.
You'll have to explain the link to... Obviously, I understand, but you might have to explain the link.
In the last series of Silent Witness, when they appear to be starting to... I mean... I'm sure they're not, but it did appear for a while they were deliberately kind of writing it for me. A key clue is when an Albanian drugs gang, one of them is blown up in his meth lab, and his FK Partizani shirt melts onto his body. And quick as a flash, Clarissa recognises FK Partizani's badge seared onto his chest.
Well, look, we don't need to answer the film question. It's a lovely way to finish. Thanks for your time, Wilson.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on such a dark day for you.
Well, I've had six paracetamols and two ibuprofen so far, and I think with another two of each, I should make it through the afternoon.
So I think that's probably your limit. Ben, thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoy the playoff final today.
Thank you.
Faye, thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.